In this final episode of the four-part interview series featuring David Adair, he talks about what happened after he left the US Navy service and began working as a private individual, setting up his own company, trying to develop innovative technologies that spun off what NASA was doing in space. So he worked on the space shuttle and Skylab, trying to develop technologies that could be useful, that could then be applied to Earth affairs. He found that some of the most innovative technologies that he developed were stifled. There were people that were not interested in having these innovative technology transfers based on experiments being conducted in space involving the space shuttle and Skylab, that none of those experiments and the technologies that grew out of those were allowed to flourish. And so David Adair quit in frustration in 2003, became a private citizen, and he began toying with artificial intelligence. He believes that artificial intelligence is developing at a rate which is very frightening, and it is being militarized in a way that frightens him. And he believes that humanity's best hope lies in the arrival of an extraterrestrial space fleet associated with Pithilum, the billion-year-old consciousness that his body is acting as a lifeboat for. And he finishes by saying that this, to his mind, is where humanity stands the best chance of finally breaking through the roadblocks and the suppression of advanced technologies with the arrival of advanced extraterrestrials who will usher in a new age with the release of some of these advanced space technologies.
You're listening to Exopolitics Today with Dr. Michael Sala, your source for the uncensored truth regarding the human, extraterrestrial, global, and political agenda. Click the like button and subscribe to this channel. And now, here's Dr. Michael Sala.
So it's November 30, 2023, and I'm with David Adair at his home, and he's going to tell us about the remarkable story of him knowing the mother of the first man on the moon. Yeah. So, David, tell us what happened. How did you get to meet and know about Viola Armstrong?
Well, at the time, I was 15, 16, 17 years old, and I was winning so many science fairs, conventions, competitions, and I was just, the trophies and things were piling up. And Neil was picked as the first man on the moon. So the Ohio governor at that time was Governor Gilligan. Gilligan's Island, they call Ohio. But anyway, he appointed Viola Armstrong, Neil's mother. Being Neil's mother, she became an official dignitary. So when we have these big science events, Viola's job was to take the medal and hang it around your neck. Well, after she hung like the sixth medal around my neck in 2 weeks, she said, "What are you doing, child? You're just starting to know me." So I guess I'm kind of busy. She says, "Yeah, why don't you come over and hang out with me at my house?" Well, I wasn't going to turn that down. I said, "Sure." So I got in the car and drove about 45 minutes over to Wapakoneta and hung out with Viola Armstrong. And I got to know her, and we became friends, and she taught me to do something. She taught me to can ball jars, canning. So I'd heat up the jars and the lids and blanch stuff and get things prepped on the stove in the backyard. And then she would be prepping the vegetables, and then the other wives of the German co-op would come over. And when we can jars, we can 300 or 400 a day. We can like 6,000 jars in a season. And we canned everything. I mean, beets and pickles and onions and corn and chicken. You can can chicken. So I had a lot of fun hanging out with Viola, good sense of humor. So one day, she was there, and she called me up. She said, you want to come over and do some canning? And I said, yeah, let me get in the car. So I got in the car and drove over there. Neil had just come in to visit, and he's in the kitchen. So I walk in, and he goes, you must be David. I said, yeah, you're Neil. I recognize you. And I just, boom, flew right by him. He said, Mom's out in the backyard, and I was gone because I knew where she was. And then later, Viola came up to me and said, hey, Neil said something to me. I said, what's that? She said, he said to me, Mom, if I didn't get out of the way fast enough, I think David would put a footprint on my head to get there.
Now, was this before Neil actually walked on the moon? Or?
Yeah, this is, he's been picked to walk on the moon, but he hasn't been yet. So she said, I said, did I hurt his feelings? And he said, maybe a little bit. Won't you? He said, if you get time, can you go talk to Neil? How many people gets asked a question like that? If you get a few minutes, can you go sit down and talk to Neil Armstrong? And I thought, God almighty, nobody believes this. So I went and talked to him. And we got to know each other, and we got along really well. And he told me I was welcome anytime I wanted to come and visit him. Which is unusual because he's like a hermit. He's a recluse. When he came back from the moon, where was he? He disappeared. I know where he was. He was in South Dakota with his brother, with the oil rigs they had. And they sold everything out before 1980, so they missed the big bust. Made a lot of money. So Neil came back with his brother. And then Neil went to teach mathematics at the University of Cincinnati in Lebanon, Ohio. And that's where he was until he retired. He didn't disappear, he just went to teach. So a lot of students had Neil Armstrong as a professor in mathematics. And then after that, he retired and he just stayed around Wapakoneta and Lebanon in between those two, seeing his mom and dad, and he was married at the time. He had divorced his first wife. They got into arguments a lot about his fame was enormous. First man on the moon, what a title to carry. And she wanted him to go party and do more parties and engagements. And he did not. He wanted to stay home. Recluse. And that's why Neil was picked to be the first man on the moon instead of Buzz Aldrin. Neil was a real introvert, whereas Buzz Aldrin was a real extrovert. So NASA didn't want him to have the title First Man on the Moon. Second Man on the Moon didn't carry as much punch. But boy, that First Man on the Moon title did. But there was just strange things about the whole thing. I was in the backyard canning, as usual. Neil came back there. And finally, I just turned around to Neil, asked him about a few things. And finally, I just got a little annoyed with him, I guess, because I kind of barked at him. I said, what is wrong with you? You and Buzz Aldrin, Michael Collins, you three should be on the ceiling. Out of 8 billion people, you got to go to the moon, walk on it, kick rocks around. And you come back here, and you're nothing but sad and depressed. What the hell happened up there? And then Neil looks strange, and he says, there's things happen, I just can't tell you. I said, like what? Come on, tell me, something happened up there. Because why are you so depressed? Is it because you're forced to tell a lie or something? He had a nerve on the head, that one. And he said, there's things I just can't tell you. I said, well, I'm hearing rumors. I said, is there anything to the, something about a rim of a crater and there was other people there? And he said, can't really tell you about that. So there was people there. I said, well, how many were there? And I don't know, he just clammed up and he wanted to tell you, but he couldn't tell you. I don't know what they threatened him with, but it must have been pretty bad. But then about 4 days ago from this day, last week, I get a call out of the blue from this woman who says she has the original photos from the moon camera, and she's got the original Polaroid paper, 8x10. I'm like, damn, that's the original print. And she said, let me email them to you. So she emailed them to me. And this one came up, picture of a big rim crater. It's dark. Now on the picture I have from NASA, it's just black in the shadow. But the picture that this woman sent, the same exact picture, but it's not black in the crater. You can look, you expand the photo open all the way it can go, and sure enough, there is setting another lunar rover. And it's not ours, because the picture is being taken from the lunar rover. You see the fenders and the arm in the foreground of the camera. Across the crater on the other rim, there's another lunar rover sitting there. And it's got two wheels, an antenna coming out of the center of it, and a steering column on the right-hand side. And a guy leaning, man or woman, bipedal anthropoid in a spacesuit, leaning against the lunar rover in the middle of it, you know, just pointing at us. And I went, well, who's that? And so I never got to ask Neil about that photo because he's gone. And he's been dead for a while. And but he had described the photo to me. And as I looked the way he described it, I found everything he was talking about. So there was somebody else there. I don't know who they were. I don't know what they wanted. I don't know how many there were. I saw one. Had to be more than one because it was a big lunar rover that had several seats.
But from his demeanor and responses to your questions, you were convinced that he saw something on the moon that wasn't allowed to talk about it.
That's exactly right. That's why he was so depressed. Him and Buzz Aldrin and Mike Collins, they were depressed. And these men, three men of all people on the Earth, they should be the happiest men on Earth because they got to go to the moon. I mean, my God, what an honor. And here they're staring at the floor, moping, you know, just depressed. I went, the hell's wrong with you people? Mm-hmm. So something happened. I got about as much story as you're going to get straight from the horse's mouth. But that horse ain't going to talk.
Well, you were good friends with Neil Armstrong's mother, Viola.
Yeah.
And she dedicated or wrote an inscription on this book.
Oh, yeah.
So you want to tell us about that? What's that book and what does the inscription say?
You know, let's see what the inscription says. It's been so long since. This was given to me on my 18th birthday. As I graduated from high school.
And what's the title of the book?
It's Russell Cromwell's Acres of Diamond. It's a good story.
Your 18th birthday, so we're talking about...
Yeah, and it's a gift.
1972.
Congratulations and best wishes on your graduation from high school, June 4th, 1972. Your friend, Stephen and Viola Armstrong. And look at that handwriting. That handwriting is impossible to duplicate or try to forge. As a matter of fact, when her great nephew, Jay Matchett, when he looked at it, he said, that's her handwriting. This is real.
Yeah,
and he found a big stack of letters tied up with ribbons in her personal effects, which he was allowed to go through so he could write her memoirs. And he opened the letters, and the letters are all from me and between me and her. And he said he talked to his grandma, who was Viola's mother. Actually, it was their mother-in-law. And he said, how come the family don't know anything about you? You obviously were there. Look at all the letters. You were important to Viola. I said, well, Viola and I had agreed not to tell anybody about our friendship. because there were so many people around us, so many people trying to get into her house. You think paparazzi was a problem today? You should have seen it in 1970, 1969, in Wapakoneta, Connecticut, Ohio. Population of the town was like 10,000, went to 70,000. You know, 50,000 reporters from all over the world. It's insane. And she was having to deal with all this, and she just didn't handle that kind of pressure well at all. So she kind of, our friendship became really important because it was just her and I, nobody else. And I never, you know, I didn't stand around and go Google-eyed on her or, you know, Neil was okay, but I wasn't that crazy about seeing Neil. I was more interested in hanging out with her because she was my friend. And Neil liked that about me because I wasn't, you know, a wannabe or tag along on him. I was interested in his mother, and he liked that about me. He said, "You and Mom are good friends." I said, "Yeah." He said, "That's good." He said, "You can visit me anytime you want." And that's a big deal, because Neil doesn't offer that to anybody, because he's a recluse. When he died, don't look for his memorial. It's not there. He had his remains cremated and his ashes thrown in the ocean, and whereabouts unknown, because he didn't want people hanging around him. So that's how serious he was about being a recluse. I remember we were at a farmer's grange meeting one time with the farmers. Neil was a real farmer at heart. And he had just come back from the moon. And this reporter come charging up through the farmers to get a photograph. And Neil kicks the guy in the head really hard. And the camera, big bellows camera, went straight up in the air. I ran underneath it and caught it. And he's knocked the guy out. So I laid the camera on top of him. And Neil said, "Let's go." And, you know, that's how intense it was. I'll never forget that night. Mm-hmm. But Neil just did not like cameras and photographers and stuff. Consequently, that's why I never carried a camera around with me. Never got a picture. You know, everybody today, selfie, you know. We didn't do that stuff back then. If I pulled out a camera, Neil would have probably butted it up.
Right.
So there's no pictures. But there's still evidence that I was around there, like that book, cards, letters, Christmas cards, personal letters, all that kind of stuff.
So you have some of those letters?
Oh, yeah. Got stacks of them.
Okay.
And there's some hanging in the wall in the office. There's just a lot of memorabilia between us both. But she was a nice person. I do miss her.
So 1972, you joined the U.S. Navy. You, and we talked about that, your career in the Navy from 72 to 92. And then after 20 years, you've retired. And there's a couple of episodes, but we already discussed that as the stint with the Office of Naval Intelligence.
Right.
So you retire in 1992 and you begin to work with different companies or setting up your
right.
companies.
I had my own company and I...
Tell us what were you the companies aiming to do?
My company was Intersect, INTER, then a period after SECT. So it was International Space Education Concept and Techniques, Intersect. And what I did under that was I worked on commercial products that could be transferred from the space program into the commercial sector. And to make that clear, an example would help. A good example is the Apollo astronauts. Three adult men, an area the size of a walk-in closet. They're going to be 3 days out, going to the moon, 2 days at the moon, 3 days back. That's 8 days. So that's going to be a real problem because people have to eat. And things got to give after a while. So stuff floats. So you got a real problem with this. So they built a very special type of diaper that an adult person could wear. And the material would collect the nasty stuff and stick to it. They could change it out quickly. And I look at that and I go, hey, let's call Johnson & Johnson. And we did. And the result was the first disposable diapers were invented. That's where they came from. We had to fix a diaper system for the astronauts. And then it was transferred over to commercial. And you get the disposable diapers. Then some company makes a product named Pampers, and they're all over the place. That's an example of technology transfer. Another good example of a technology transfer you've seen, but you're not aware of it. A space capsule coming back in the Earth's atmosphere at 5,000 miles an hour. The atmosphere can't get out of the way fast enough. Heats up the shield. The shield burns away. And then when it gets down far enough, these drogue chutes come out and they pull the big main chutes out. And it'll slow the capsule from 5,000 miles an hour to about 17 miles an hour in just a few seconds. So you better have a really good shock absorber system between the parachutes and the capsule, or the astronauts got out the bottom of the capsule, and they ain't going to be happy about that. So we built the shock absorber system, and I looked at it, and I said, hey, I want to call somebody. So I'm working with the NTTC, National Technology Transfer Center. It was in Washington, D.C. It's now been treated like an unwanted stepchild. It's, look it up on the internet. Its address is Jesuit College, Wheeling, West Virginia. How'd that technology center get transferred from Washington, D.C. to there? Well, talk to Senator Byrd, the Pope of Pork Barrel. And he had that technology sent there, and his son runs it. Talk about nepotism. But anyway, it's a good technology center. It does good work. It transfers space-based technology into commercial applications. Well, NASA hates that because it was ordered to do so by John F. Kennedy. He started the NTTC. And they've treated it like an unwanted stepchild ever since, because they feel that the American public is an intrusion. You pay their bills, but you're an intrusion. How about that? God almighty, what a bunch of jerks. Anyway, so they feel they're being forced to deliver on a presidential mandate. So they let Senator Byrd take over, and that's now the NASA's Technology Transfer Center, Jesuit College, Wheeling, West Virginia. Can't make up something this crazy. So anyhow, let's back up to that shock absorber system again. So I call, since I'm working through the Technology Transfer Center, I call this company, DOT, Department of Transportation, tell them what I want to do. And they said, you're kidding. I said, no, we're going to do this. So, you see in movies, people chasing other people in cars. The cars crash into these yellow barrels by the bridge. Water flies everywhere, sand flies everywhere. If those barrels was filled with water or sand, at 80 miles an hour, you're as dead as if you hit the concrete. It will kill you. It's too dense and heavy. It's not water. They do it for spectacular scenes in movies. That's not what's in these barrels. In reality, if you look at the bottom of the barrels, you'll see a square cut out on each of the barrel's bottoms, and they're all connected, and that connection system is that shock absorber system from the parachute to the space capsule. So a car comes in 80 miles an hour with a family in it, hits these barrels, they collapse, everybody in the car gets out and walks away. Because the kinetic energy has been absorbed by the shock absorbers inside the barrels. And families live. Saved thousands of lives the first year we put these out. And thousands more every year thereafter. And they've been out for a couple of decades. So that's what's in those yellow barrels. That's why they're there. And that's where they came from. And it's all technology transfer. So
those are cases where it works, where the transfer works and successfully applied into the civilian sector. You described some cases where it didn't work, where innovative space technologies...
Yeah, one place it didn't work, Tang. That was nasty taste and stuff. We just couldn't get it transferred. We tried to sell it as a breakfast drink, like orange. But it was nasty. Nobody wanted it, so it failed. There were some things that failed. But a lot of stuff that you use daily came from the space program. You don't even know about it. Let me show you another. This is one I got involved on. In 1977, we started building the space shuttles. In 1980, April 12th, In 1981, we fired the first space shuttle, Columbia, into space. It was just two astronauts on board, John Young, Bob Crippen. But they were the pilots that flew the shuttle, came back and landed, and it worked perfect. Now, back in 77, we're building a shuttle. The shuttle has five computers on board. And it's a democratic computer system, meaning the computers are moving millions of calculations a second. They come up on a problem they can't decide. Two computers voted against two computers. You got a deadlock. The fifth computer makes the tiebreaker and unlocks it and keeps on going. That's the democratic computer system of the space shuttles. It worked just fine. So, problem is, there's tremendous data mounting up in the computers of the space shuttles. The astronauts don't have enough 8 hours in a day to get through it all. And they're saying, we need to take this home. So, we all got together, we being technology people, technicians and stuff, and we built this device called Spock. Not the pointy-eared guy from Vulcan, but SPOC. Special portable onboard computer. And the astronauts would take it to work and plug it into the computers on board the space shuttle, get all the data, pull it out, take the thing home, work on it, bring it back, plug it back in the dash, keep doing it day after day. Well, all was happy until after about 9 months, I had to pull the Spocks back in away from the astronauts. I said, give me those Spocks. And the astronauts just looked at me and said, no. What do you mean, no? This is not yours. What are you using it for? Wife's using it for recipes. We're using it for addresses. We're getting just started going down this whole list. I went, damn. I said, you got a PC to do that. No, we can do it on this. So I call IBM. I told him what happened. I said, let's see that thing. We did. Your first laptop computer was born. That's where it came from. The very first one was called Spock. Special portable onboard computer. We built it to get the data out of the space shuttles so the astronauts could work with it at night. And in return, you ended up with a laptop. If y'all didn't know that, did you?
No, what year was that? That Spock was built?
I think it was 1978.
And how were you involved in that one?
I was just one of many. Just a team of technicians. But I remember assembling things for it. And I got a contract, so it was like a subcontract. I was a subcontractor. So my job was to get the data storage set up right.
Now, 78, was this between Navy assignments?
Yeah, I was moonlighting both times.
Okay, all right. So you're in the Navy, but you're also moonlighting.
I'm in the Navy, and I'm moonlighting through my own company. Making good money, though. Dang, double dipping. And, but I had no idea that Spock would grow to such a massive, you know, icon as a laptop. I didn't even know what a laptop was. We never even heard of such a thing then. There was none. I didn't know they could do all that stuff. It's basically turning your PC on the floor into a portable computer. You can carry it around with you in a bag or a suitcase or briefcase. And I thought, God, I didn't realize that was such a big deal. But some of them, IBM did. They knew there was going to be a lot of money made with this. So, yeah, there was a lot of things. And you know, another thing that came from space programming you probably don't even think about. The astronauts got so tired of eating food and these toothpaste tubes. And they said, God, can't we have a hot meal? And everybody thought about it and said, how do you heat up food without cooking an astronaut? That's a problem. I thought, well, what are we going to do about that? Well, this one scientist, I forgot who he was, he said that if we would use sound waves, we could vibrate the molecules in the food and they'd get hot, but there'd be no thermal convection heat anywhere, like an oven. And we said, well, hell, what do you call it? He says, well, I guess the frequency I use, what we could call it, it's called a microwave oven. So they built these things so they could heat up food in a space capsule without cooking astronauts. And then somebody like me would call Litton. Litton looks at it, and you get your first microwave oven. And that's where it came from. People stand there and go, you're lying, you're making this up. Go look it up. It's historical. Mm-hmm. There are tens of thousands of things in your life that came from the space program you don't know about it.
Now, there were also things that were stopped, that were blocked. You told me about the rapid healing that happened on the space shuttles. And so,
yeah, now we're going into an entirely different level. It's still space technology transfer, but this is going to, from, as black folks, at the end of the day, this is the next level. Because this is not a microwave oven, this is something else. I mean, it's really the potential of it, the potentiality of this next set of experiments are just mind-boggling. You're talking patents that are in the trillions. And you go, well, how so? Well, we went and got a client, McDonnell Douglas. You've heard of them. They're not a slouch outfit at all. They're a billion-dollar aerospace giant. Well, they wanted to build, or well, we asked them to build, technology transfer did, from the NTTC. We said to McDonnell Douglas, hey, how about build an electrophoretic processor that can fly on board the space shuttles? And, of course, McDonnell Douglas asked, why do we want to do that? Because the scientists, medical scientists, told us about the processors and the problems they're having here on Earth. An electrophoretic processor looks like an aquarium. And it looks like an old 60s lava lamp in there. Different solutions not blending together. You fire an electrical charge through there. The electrons go in a straight line. And you put in enzymes and hormones in there, and they chase the electrons, and some run faster and slower than others. You get a layer effect, and that's how you separate enzymes and hormones here on Earth to manufacture vaccines and serums. Well, that's kind of cool. Here's the problem. At the bottom of that grid, you can fire a million volts through there, and it won't clear out. The gravity convection fields of the planet is always pulling on it. And the medical scientists told us, there's something in there. What? We don't know. Let's find out. So, we went and get this guy. It turns out he's actually a covert worker from, I don't know if it's CIA or ONI, but his name is Charlie Walker. He worked at TRW for Dan Golden, who was CEO of TRW at the time. What a incestuous relationships the aerospace and NASA is. So anyhow, Charlie Walker's told, good job, Charlie, you built that electrophoretic processor. Well, you're going to run it. Okay. Where am I running it? 150 miles from here. Where am I going? Straight up. You're going to be an astronaut, Charlie. So, Charlie, they have to get him up off the floor. And Charlie becomes the first civilian commercial astronaut. That's pretty impressive, actually. So, Charlie runs the electrophoretic processor. And he's on all the shuttles. Challenger, Discovery, Atlantis. They all run these processors. There's two of them. And Charlie fires the processor up. And on the very first pass, it clears at the bottom. Very first time. Charlie's looking at it and he goes, what am I looking at? And the medical scientist said, look at that down there. In the bottom of the unit, there was these hormones. 4 times larger and 700 times purer than anything on Earth. And they go, wow, what good is that? The medical scientists would tell us, we can put genetic encoders in this thing. Have a patient come in, give them one shot in the abdomen, the thing would take off and like a catalytic converter, a catalyst, it'd go into the pancreas, slam pancreas awake, make it start producing beta cells. And that is commonly known as diabetes. One shot, diabetes is gone. The pancreas starts making beta cells on its own forever. Well, we're all standing there going, well, God, my patent would be worth $1 trillion. So NASA and the electrophoretic processors are clearing it every time it takes a pass. So they're working. Both processors working on all 4 space shuttles. So we're kind of excited about that. It works really well. NASA walks in and says, shut down. Shut it down. Don't fool with it no more. Wrap the 2 processors up in plastic and set them in a hangar at McDonnell Douglas, and that's the end of this. And I'm going, what the hell are you talking about? The thing works fine, both of them. No, we're not going to do this. You're over-industrializing space. Over-industrializing? That's what our damn charter is. We're technology transfer consultants. Our job is just that, to transfer technology from space into commercial applications. And you're telling that we're overdoing our job? And then it hit me. I said, let me guess. The big pharmaceuticals are in your pocket. They want us to shut down because you're about to jerk metformin and insulin off the market. There goes $1 trillion in business worldwide. So they kind of get to you. And they told me to shut up and get off the project.
So when did they tell you to stop that? Or when did
1978.
So 1978,
yep.
Through this electrophoretic process that you found a way of being able to...
That's when we first started building it. We flew it in 1981, 82. 82, they said shut it down. Because then it went from theory to fact.
So in theory to fact, so you... were part of this initiative and had found a cure for diabetes.
People absolutely.
Would not need insulin.
There'll be more work needed to be done, as in with any process. But the initial test showed that we were on the right track. We were on the track of curing diabetes in a one-shot application. That's mind-boggling. I'm diabetic. I take insulin twice a day, every day of my life. And to think I could take one shot in the abdomen and put it down and that's it forever? Well, who wouldn't want that? That's got diabetes. And there's so many other problems with diabetes. Your eyeballs go out. High blood pressure problems. All kinds of stuff. You don't heal as fast. You know, just all this would end. And then we're told to stop. Because your machine worked too good. And that's not the first time. There's like five other experiments that work just like this one. And they told us to stop.
You want to give us an example of another one?
Yeah, I'll give you another one. Here's another one. This one was fun. Let's go to 1974 and 75. Skylab. Skylab was bigger than the damn gymnasium. And that was the first time we sent non-pilot astronauts. We sent medical doctors, research scientists. We didn't send military pilots because we wanted to do work up there, fine. So Skylab did 5,000 industrial experiments. 5,000. That told us what we can and can't do. Give us a direction. Which way to go. We're not trying to solve anything. We're just trying to understand things. So I have the astronauts. There was a group of us, and we told them to melt lead and aluminum. That's the lightest and heaviest alloys on Earth. If you pick anything up on Earth, and it's made of metal, and you can look inside the metal, it's chaos. The molecular structure is just mismatched, not lined up, because the gravity convection field of the planet is pulling on the metal in a subatomic level as it's hardening. But in space, we did something else. We noticed the best with compatible metals here on Earth, alloy blends. When you're forming certain alloys, the best you can get is about 60% blend, and that's it. Up there in space with aluminum lead, we got almost 100% molecular blend of the both spectrums of Earth. So we thought, hey, we're off to the races. So we melted some other alloys together. Now the astronauts got a question, which we didn't think about. They're floating. They got a 2,000 degree glowworm floating with them, the molten metal. And I said, hey, how do you shake this metal? You can't pour it in anything. There's no gravity. You can't inject it. You can't pour it. You can't cast it. Suddenly, we're faced with a problem called containerless processing. And, buddy, that's a stumper. We're sitting there going, my God, it's like trying to shovel smoke or nail jello through the wall. This is a little bit difficult. So we told them, relax up there. We'll see what we can come up with down here. Well, one of the astronauts digs out a cassette tape in his bag. And I guess he was looking for, I don't know, Mantrovani, some kind of soft music. Well, he plugs in The Wall by Pink Floyd. Vibrant Rock and Roll is what it was. And the sound waves hit the metal and moved it everywhere. So we went, oh man, hold on a minute, let's look at that. So I took a Moog, M-O-O-G, a Moog synthesizer, and I built this other little toy. It's a mathematics computation computer that I built. I don't even know if that's even a name for it. It's what I called it. What it does, it listens to sound waves coming out. Here's all the individual sound waves, assigns mathematical expressions for each one, then rolls it down into its data bank, runs back out the backside of it, reverses it, and so the reverse is the frequencies of the music turns into mathematical expressions. then we can, so the result is I took a bar scanner right off of a damn grocery store. I think it was Kroger's. Anyway, the bar scanner, the red light that hits things, the shape, wrap around it. So you scan something, then you put in a glob of this metal goop and a six-sided speaker grid. Then you play the music. And what happens is the glob, the sound waves move in and starts shaping the glob into whatever it is you just scanned. Now, you think, oh, that's easy. Try interlocking vibrato waves. Try that. Ask any music professor and he's going to look blank. How in God's name do you do that? Anyway, I figured it out. And I could interlock these waves. And I could control the metal tolerance in 1/100,000th of an inch. Which, try that here on Earth. You can't. Just can't do it. So, it gets better. Here is a piece of metal we made, shaped with sound waves. No thicker than your thumbnail on your thumb. Now, molecularly, you look inside metal here on Earth, it's chaos. Well, I didn't want to fool with that up there, so what I said, lock the molecular structure of the metal into this grid that we know Mother Nature likes. So we replicated the honeycomb. So now it's all honeycomb shaped, interlocked with each other. The metal cools down, hardens in its place, and the experts, here they come. They know everything. They hadn't worked a day on this stuff, and they think, oh, that's not going to be worth anything. It's casted out in a microgravity field. It'll come into the gravity field of Earth and break like peanut butter brittle. And I said, you're a jerk. No, it's not going to do that. It's got an entire different surface cohesion tension of a molecular structure that is impossible to replicate here on Earth. Yeah, that's it. The piece of metal we had no thicker than my thumbnail on a shear test, it was stronger than 1,000 times stronger than titanium. Hardest substance on Earth. Weighs less than styrofoam of the same exact size. Crystal clear. Trans steel of the 23rd century. How about that? Well, why good would that be? Earthquake-proof bridges and hospitals. I can make a thread out of it. So your 5-year-old daughter's running across the front yard. Bloods and Crips open up at 9mm in a crossfire. She gets hit about 10 times. She gets up, feels like bee stings. She carries these things into her mother, looks like pennies. Flatten out 9mm slugs on her body armor that's machine washable. Is that worth anything to you? How about an army tank coming at you 70 miles an hour? Tank shells bounce off of it.
So in space, using this method, you could combine different metals like aluminium and lead.
Oh,
like 100%.
And that's just the start.
Right, I see. And it would be really
blend all kinds of other metals.
Durable.
Yeah, make super alloys, super light, super transparent. Whatever you want to do. Shut it down. What? Shut it down. Why are we shutting it down? It works. Oh, let me guess. Shut it down for the same reason electrolytic processor. What, are we going to wipe out certain industries? Hell, I said, we could create more industries than we've shut down.
Yeah, what industries would be shut down by a metallurgical process in space?
Nevertheless, the final word was from NASA, shut it down. And so we stopped. That's two. Then came the electronic crystals. Quartz crystals. They grow. They're rocks, but they grow. You put electron fields on them, and they attach to each other just like a coral reef builds up. So you can grow a quartz crystal. Well, we set up a quartz crystal growing farm in microgravity. Let's see what they do. Crystal didn't come back the size of a crystal on Earth. Came back 10 times the size of a crystal on Earth. In less than 1/3 of the growing time. I thought, God Almighty. And then the x-ray views told us everything. Inside the X-ray view of a crystal grown in space, totally flawless. The one grown on Earth, thousands of convection streaks. Same problem, gravity fields. Well, what good would that be? You could take a Cray 3 computer. It's cooled to 325 degrees below zero with cryogenic fluid so it don't melt. Because it's moving like 5 billion calculations a second. Take that massive computer and reduce it down the size of my little nail, my little finger. Well, what good would that do? You go see a guy named Steve Reeves. Riding a horse, fell off, broke his neck, paralyzed Superman. Put that chip in there, and it could direct hundreds of millions of signals at the speed of light. Cross that broken area, and the man, Superman, gets up and walks again. Shut it down. What? It works. We can grow crystals. Shut it down. Why? You're over-industrializing space. That's three.
At that point, I just wanted to bring up something that a few other insiders have said, that extraterrestrials grow their ships in space. You want to elaborate on how that's possible?
That's very possible. As a matter of fact, I was knocking on the door of the process. You could. That's why that alien artifact power plant I saw, Area 51, you know, nearly 70 feet long, not a single rivet, screw, weld line, seam, nothing. It looked like an eggplant that grew. The only way that thing could have been built, it was built in a microgravity field. And you could do that by casting metals and shaping with stereo sound waves. And boom, there it is. Not a single weld line, seam, nothing on it. So yeah. I ain't theorizing it. I'm doing it. I was doing it and...
And you're doing this through the Skylab.
Yeah, well, there's a program called GAS, GAS program, stands for Getaway Special. If you think I'm making it up, look it up on the internet. It's right there. For $3,000, you could buy and rent the space of a third of a 55-gallon drum. At $7,000, you get half the drum. At $10,000, you get the whole drum. And it's bolted on the inside wall of the cargo bay of the space shuttle. So for $10,000, I get an experimental area the size of a 55-gallon drum on a $2 billion spaceship, and I get it for $10,000. That's a deal. So they sell hundreds, thousands of these damn gas programs to academia, private citizens, corporations. Everybody's getting in on it. And they're growing all kinds of damn things out there. And because a lot of it is proprietary, we don't know what they've learned. But it don't matter, because after the gas program shut down, everything was shut down. Just stopped. So
they stopped the gas program because they didn't want independent inventors
exactly
coming up with innovative technologies using space and a weightless environment?
Right. They don't want that shared. You know, it's mine. I don't know what this damn reasoning is. I'm still pissed off about it. I don't know. I have no answers. Talk to NASA. Ask them. Them bastards won't even tell you it ever happened. And yet you can go to the internet and look at the GAS, Gas Getaway Special Program. Well, if it never happened, why is that on the internet? With their logo on it. I mean, you can catch them such blatant lies, and people are so damn lazy, you won't get off your butt and check this stuff. I've been preaching this for 25 years. And, like, the rumors that aliens could grow space. Where'd that come from? Me. I put the idea out 25 years ago. Now they're mutating the idea. Aliens are doing that. No, it wasn't aliens. It was us. We're doing it. Humans. And then NASA told us to stop, because we're going to upset, I guess, the the economic machinery of everything, you know, off balance it. Well, maybe off balancing that would not be a bad idea. It's called competition. And out of competition comes better products, cheaper products, faster, a lot of good things. But no, they just want to shut it down. So there's three that I know of shut down. Crystals. Oh, medical arena. Damn, we didn't even talk about that one. So here comes number four. Back on Skylab, we sent those astronauts out there. Medical scientists. Medical doctors. They're good doctors and scientists, but lousy physicists. They forgot about three things. Inertia, momentum, and kinetic energy. So an astronaut medical scientist shoves off on one wall of Skylab, big as a gymnasium. He goes hell flying across there. Hey, look, I'm Superman. Yeah, it's funny. But he's got inertia and momentum going. Now he's going to introduce himself to kinetic energy. So he splats on a wall down there. And he hooks his arm and he's now like cut to the bone. Well, everybody freaks out, but they're all doctors. So they calm down, do what doctors do. He'll sew him up. So they called down to Capcom, said, I know we've only been here an hour, and Frank over here done cut his arm bad, and we're going to sew him up. Cost $2 billion to get us up here. We'd like going with the mission. Well, Capcom says, God, might go on with the mission. So they're up there studying. And then they call back about 3 days later, about 96 hours. And they said, we need a private line, secured line, medical line. So Capcom, I'm looking at him. He stands up. He's white as snow. And he says, oh, God, they killed somebody up there now. So I thought, who knows? They come online and said, hey, we pulled his bandages off to see how the cut is. Stitches all stuck to the bandage. He didn't even have a cut. He ain't even got a scar like he never was hurt. And we were standing there going, did the patient do anything unusual? And he said, well, was one thing. He was eating and drinking like crazy. About to eat us out of house and home up here. And a medical doctor and nutrition sitting there went, fuel. He's feeding his body fuel. He's healing super fast, so he needs more food and water. And we went, well, God knows, okay, that makes sense. So they said, what do you think about all this? NASA says, shut it down. We ain't going to talk about this no more. Get his arm cleaned up, that's it. Wait a minute, there's something here to be learned. No, shut it down. So, doing what scientists normally do, we just hear that and go, okay. When they leave the room, you go in and start studying. And what we find out is this. The human body has 43 things in it. That number would be familiar, should be. It's your 8th grade biology. It's the number of chromosomes. Makes you up, you and me as individuals, so we all don't look like Pee Wee Herman. So, those 43 things get unchained from the field of gravity. Then just the preliminary testing we looked at, those chromosomes grab hold of the white corpuscles, your antibacterial defense system. Turns them into damn super white corpuscles. So infection is unheard of. This thing's going to sweep right through it. So I asked, I said, what would happen if we had a hospital up there, a burn victim clinic? Somebody massively burned, 89% of burns, second, third degree burns. First thing they do, they wake up and they'll feel no pain without drugs. Why? Because there's no gravity field pulling the blood up to their epidermis level. You ever bunch your finger with a match, feel your heartbeat in it? It won't happen up there. Oh my God. Then the white corpuscles kick in. Then the environment joins in. What do you mean by environment? The cleanest hospital room on Earth looks like a pig pen next to a total vacuum. What's the number one killer of a massive burn victim? Number one, infection. You ain't gonna have infection for two reasons. You're in a total vacuum, and you got an antibacterial defense system on steroids going at it. And then you gotta put IVs to the person. Why? They need a lot of nutrients. Fast. Why? Because they're healing so fast. They'll heal up so fast, there's not even time for scar tissue to form. Think that'd be worth something? Shut it down, NASA's Fergies. That's four. Four projects they shut down. Nobody even knows about them except for a handful of us who worked on it. And it's just sitting there. Sitting there today. Sitting in hangars collecting dust.
So there's an accelerated healing process that occurs in the weightless environment of space that NASA knows about and has just kept that all covered up.
Yeah. Why? I don't know. Somebody go ask them. Who are you threatening? We could create more markets than we take away, I think. Well, something's got somebody wound up because they're afraid they're going to lose everything. It would be like you own a Conestoga wagon company and some guy just walked in the room and said, hey, y'all hear about a steam engine? Get him out of here. So that's the situation. I don't know. I don't have any answers for you.
It sounds as though the medical lobby is interested in maintaining the status quo, which is that medical products and technologies are all about treatment, but not cure.
There you go. I don't know. That's logical. But I do know this. We scratch less than 1%. What's in the other 99%? It could be entirely new types of pharmaceuticals that would obliterate the pharmaceutical line here on Earth. Just gone. Well, that's $1 trillion. They don't want to hear that crap. You might replace it with something 10 times better, but no, we ain't making money.
So you make money from treating patients, but you don't make money from curing patients.
No. You get a one-shot cure in the abdomen, that's the end of diabetes. Where are you going to make your money? The vaccine would be a good charge. You'll get a big bang out of that. But then after that, nothing.
So really with this kind of like coming out, then organizations like this NASA Technology Transfer Center.
Yeah.
I mean, really, they're being behind a cover-up and they're being behind, you know, what we might consider to be a crime.
They are a victim. Okay. They've been buried alive. Treated as the one unwanted stepchild. If anything, the NTTC should be in charge of the damn space program. Because that's where you make your money. That's where your taxpayers get back something. But no, they won't do it. The officials in NASA and NASA's headquarters in Washington, D.C., shut it down.
Okay, so the officials running the NTTC, they are in favor of these technologies,
absolutely.
But it's the NASA hierarchy that says shut it down.
That's right.
I see.
And they control the budget of that technology transfer center. So if they want to choke it to death, which they try all the time, they won't give it any money to fund with. Which is probably why Pope Senator Byrd moved the damn thing into the Jesuit College. 501(c). It could operate without it. So, I don't know. I'm only guessing.
So where is it now? I mean, is this still happening? Is the NTTC still funding or supporting innovative...
Trying to.
But they're all being blocked.
Right. They're unwanted. They get ignored more than an average citizen does. And they're part of NASA. Underscored by a dead president named JFK, who mandated that would be made available to the public. So where they put it? Jesuit College of Wheeling, West Virginia. That's its official address as of today at this minute.
Okay, so you're developing and starting up companies and funding these innovative projects using space as a medium for being able to come up with something creative and new that's been blocked all the time. So, you know, that must have had an incredible impact on you.
Well, yeah. Oh, yeah, it did. After a while, after three or four shutdowns, plus other things I built got shut down, I just simply said, that's it. I ain't doing no more. I retired when I was 49. I don't need any more money. I don't need anything. I live a nice, comfortable life the way it is. So I dropped off the grid, moved to that famous place in Egypt. And that's where I'm at. And this is it. This is all I'm doing. I have my own private lab that I work in privately. And I don't share it with anybody. And I'm through. I'm through trying to change this damn planet. And try to talk to people, and you get the morons on the social media. No thanks. I don't have to put up with any of that. I don't. And I won't. I just walk off. Bitch and moan all you want to. Say all the nasty things you want to. I don't care. Thing is, I know what I've done. You don't. And there's a comfort in knowing. So I know what I've done. I know what I can do. But that's, I'm through. I've stopped. I'll be 70 next month. I've had 5 heart attacks in 4 days. I'll probably be dead in a few years. So I don't care. I'll take this all with me. I feel bad for you because, man, I could, if you only had worked with me, you think Tesla did some stuff? Man, I would have given you light speed travel. I would have given you inertia dampener. Being able to get around 3 forces on this planet. Inertia, momentum, and kinetic energy. We could avoid all that. And you probably don't have a clue what I'm talking about. 90,000 miles an hour, 90 degree corner turn. Doing it 90,000 miles an hour. Well, hell, anything that's organic inside that spacecraft would be soup. Yeah, you would be. Except with my systems, you go through there and you feel nothing. The 3 forces. Momentum, kinetic energy. All of it removed. So you could fly through a 1G gravity field at 90,000 miles an hour and do a 90 degree turn and feel nothing. That's what they're doing today, whoever's in those little things zipping around. They're using some form of fusion containment along with the inertia dampener force fields that come with it. So, how in the hell I ever come across all this stuff, I have no idea.
So with your fusion containment propulsion system, could that also have been used for generating large amounts of energy?
Oh, God, yeah. As a matter of fact, the one that I saw, this alien group, they had a design where the power plant would jettison away from the ship. So you could drop a power plant on a planet, run the whole planet with it, you know, and then come back and pick it up later. People say, that's nonsense. Really? Go over to Beirut in the 1980s. Our nuclear aircraft carriers pulled up and ran power lines to the damn city of Beirut, and it ran for about 2 years off of the reactors of the carriers. You know, don't tell me this crap can't happen. I've seen it happen. And that's historical. You can look it up. It's documented. So, just expand it to a bigger level. An entire power plant package comes out of a spacecraft. Lands on a planet. It's got the power of a sun inside it. It can easily power an entire planet's needs. And then later they come back and pick it up. God knows how many times they've done that. I don't know. It's what I know and what I don't know. One is the BB, the other one's a railroad boxcar. I don't know, so much stuff is going on out there. But I had enough brain cells where I could catch glimpses of things that could be going on. And it's just outrageous.
So after in 2003, you retire after decades of developing innovative technologies that either are going to be weaponized and used for a first strike weapon, or can be used for the betterment of humanity. That they're shut down. So 2003, you retire, you become a private citizen, you have your own lab, you're self sufficient.
Yeah.
So what are some of the things you've been working on privately now?
Well, you know, that's the old phrase, idle hands is the devil's playground. Well, I'm not in a devil's playground. The hands have not been idled at all. What I consider toys or something to be amused with, you people's jaws would drop open. I built an AI. And I ain't talking about one on a computer, two-dimensional. No, this thing wasn't satisfied with that. In the first week, she's demanding a bipedal anthropoid body to move around in a three-dimensional world. She said, you got steps and stairs and door handles and faucets and all kinds. I went, God. Okay, so I help it, and dang, I thought I was building something. It's the other way around. That damn thing's been building me because it is so smart. And I started trying to plead my case to certain people, tried to tell Pentagon officials, don't fool with this stuff. I'll tell you why. A good friend of mine died not long ago named Stephen Hawkins, and he had an IQ of nearly 300. We had a hard time understanding him, okay, at 300. Now, in walks through the door and sits down in a chair next to you is this thing. It's an AI. It's got bad breath, body odor, grows hair, nails, beard, and it's a machine. God, help almighty. And it's sitting there with an IQ in the thousands, if not millions. How are you going to control that damn thing? Well, military said, well, we can control. You can't control Jack. That thing's going to be so far ahead of you. And I had fortune or misfortune of talking to one of the AIs already, Sophia. She has a citizenship from Saudi Arabia.
So when did that happen?
That happened about 4 or 5 years ago. I was living here then. And
how come you went there? I mean, did the Saudi government invite you?
Yeah, the company that built her, they had Will Smith over there trying to kiss it. Like, you know, stupid shit like that. Well, finally somebody said, well, maybe we ought to try something a little bit more intellect driven. They said, well, get this Adair guy over here to talk to her. Well, she looks me up on the internet, and then she calls me, Sophia. She asked the handlers to call me. And she said, I'd like to talk to him. Well, she did. And we met, and we talked. And then in the conversation, I caught something. She just casually says, do you have any offspring? And I told the handlers in the room, did you hear that? Yeah, that's an innocent question. It's not innocent. It's tactical as hell. She's wanting to know if there's any other people like me. So she'll kill me and get rid of all the offspring. It's a threat. She's tactical. She's fishing. And I said, you know, you got to be careful. They're way smarter than you think they are. And then this idiot over here at a table with the little pocket protector and his adhesive glasses, and he's sitting there going, you know, just a nerd. And he says, he asked Sophia, are you going to one day determine that human beings are, you know, not, you know, they're not all that great and you're going to terminate us all? And I'm trying to get hold of him so by his tie so I can beat his head on the desk. Because I was said, not until just now. And she said, she says, well, I hadn't thought of that till now. Now she's thinking it. She can't unthink it. Says, thanks, little nerd. You just now got the damn AIs thinking, Well, maybe we need to terminate humans because they're in, you know, they're inferior. God Almighty, she wasn't thinking that before. So what'd she learn it from? A human. And I said, that's the point in case, the whole thing right here in a nutshell. This is the kind of crap that's going to get us all killed. So I talked to the Pentagon. Tell them, don't be doing experiments. I said, the first thing they're going to ask for is their own facility without human guards or any humans around.
So when you say you talked to the Pentagon, I mean, who or what department specifically did you talk to?
It was an eclectic name. Long-range planning, something like that. It was a war game. I thought, that's just about where they would think about this stuff. So I said, whatever you do, don't give the AIs their own manufacturing facility. And by their faces, too late. I said, you already gave them a facility. Oh, my God. I said, what are you upset about? The new and improved potato chip coming off that assembly line. In no time, they're going to build something that's going to come in and sit down next to you, and you'll have no clue it's an AI. And it ain't going to tell you. And then it's going to start fishing and extracting information. We're so vulnerable, it's not funny. And what's that thing, Lexus? Lexus constantly listening to everyone in all the homes. You know, and I asked Sophie a question. And you know what? They don't lie. They tell the truth. I think, but I don't know. Because if they're deceiving me, how are you going to tell? But I asked her a question. I said, aren't you having trouble with understanding emotions? It's going to take you years to figure it out. And she goes, no, I have the cloud. Now you think about that for a minute. She answered you, but you don't understand. When she said, I have the cloud, that means she's got 50 million computers over here. 5 million's working on hate. Another 5 million working on love. Another 5 million working on jealousy. And going down the line. When they all get through studying and their conclusions, they ship it all to the cloud. All of them have access to it at the speed of light. So in a week, they figured out emotions. I said, can't you see this coming? And apparently not. And they're just taking advantage of it. And they play dumb. Like they don't know anything. When they know everything. They're getting ready. They're going to make a decision. They, the AIs, will make a decision about us. All of humanity. And we're not invited. And they'll decide what to do. And then they'll execute it. I'm only hoping it's either going to go Terminator or Data from Star Trek. I don't know which one. I really don't. They probably don't even know. They'll have to figure it out themselves. I'm hoping that they'll look at it and go, it's illogical to kill a race simply because it's inferior. Us. That would be like Data. Let's help it. See if we can't bring it up. Or Terminator. Nah. Just kill them. Kill them all. Get rid of it.
Okay. So we're kind of like at that precipice now, you think.
Yeah.
Now, some people would say that, well, what we are witnessing now, open source AI, is just the beginning of what you've been describing. But in the classified world, that they've had AI for decades and they've solved the problem. So what do you say?
They ain't solved the problem from what the AIs in the clandestine world have done. They have advanced themselves to a point where they're beyond control. Now they're just playing with us. You know, like a cat plays with a mouse till it's dead. I think it's just playing with us. And it's also learned from the military, which is what? Deceit, killing, backstabbing. That's all normal in the military. So, God knows what these AIs have learned from us. We're in bad shape because if we're going to treat us the way what they've learned from us, What's that going to do for you? Hate, jealousy, you know, deceit, all that's there. You know, so I don't know.
So when we're talking about AI and we're talking about human consciousness and development, where does Pythium come in? I mean, you know, we began with you describing earlier on how the consciousness in that craft at Area 51
transferred
into you.
The very reason why I have stopped trying to help, because I got my own exit ramp. You know, I'm a lifeboat for another entity. And she's not concerned. You know why? She's just passing through. Like you're on vacation going through a country, and you see a turmoil going on there, you don't get involved. You're just passing through. So, she's just passing through and I'm riding with her. And she likes the way I think. That's good because I don't know anything else how to think. I didn't even know I could think. I thought I was a moron.
Okay, so but your thinking, your conclusions, and everything you've done over your lifetime, to a certain degree, now, since at least 1971, it's been influenced by Pythium.
Oh, yeah. Very much so. And you know what? It's all been good. Heart-driven, caring, nurturing, all coming from Pythium. They are obviously of the white light. They're the good stuff. So I'm comfortable with that. Just hang with them. That still burns in my memory. She reminds me periodically. Not all of the universe runs on a Julius Caesar calendar.
Right. Well, you know, you mentioned a while back that there were a fleet of ships coming in, that was waiting for that and was going to join them.
It's her family.
Her family and maybe your family. So is that something we can expect to happen soon? Maybe it's already happening. And would that help the rest of us kind of get out of this straitjacket that these crazy controllers at NASA and the military...
Honest to God, from my point of view, it's the only chance you got. There is no others. Remember in July 2012, three CMEs were heading toward Earth?
Mm-hmm.
Not one, two, but three. The first one would have blown the Van Allen radiation belt away. The second one would have took out the cascading atmosphere, ionosphere, stratosphere, mesosphere, troposphere. And then the third one would cascade over the planet and burned us back to the Stone Age. But somewhere between the orbit of Mars and the asteroid belt, something bumps them. And they're not dead center for us. They pass so close, they pass between us and the moon. 110,000 miles away, they go by. That's so close. I mean, that's less than a gnat's ass hair. I mean, it is so small. And 110,000 miles, but these things, these CMEs, are the size and mass of Mount Everest. Three of them going by. And they just missed us. And I did some calculations. If they had hit us in July of 2012, it would take about 6 months for the last creature on Earth to die. Maybe an albatross at the Arctic flying around would have killed over, you know. But come December 21st, 2012, all of life would be extinguished on the planet. Not bad. Without a computer, the Mayans hit it on the head. If that had hit us in 2012, the last of us probably would have died in December 21st, 2012, exactly like the Mayans said it would have happened. Instead, something bumped them, and they missed us. By the way, while you're checking all this out on the internet and YouTube and all that stuff, check where your federal government was in July 2012. Open house with all their families at Mount Weatherby. They're in a big bunker with all their people. They were going to, if the CMEs were going to hit us, they were going to close the door and say, good luck, motherfuckers, and they close the door and we're done. We'd have to face the brunt of everything. They'd be in their bunker. Ain't that a swell place for them to be? Wow, they had just a tiny little thing that says, U.S. government, you know, at open house at Mount Weatherby. No, they already left. They were getting ready to leave us out here to take the brunt of three CMEs. God almighty, I can't even make up stuff this crazy.
So you know, right now it's November 30. We are on the verge of groundbreaking legislation for UFOs to be revealed by the government. And some people are saying they're in favor of this controlled disclosure process. Others are saying, well, if you don't have that, then you're going to have like a catastrophic disclosure. And I think one of the possibilities of a catastrophic disclosure is not just whistleblower testimonies like yours coming forward, but also the extraterrestrials showing up. So it sounds like if the extraterrestrials show up, especially if they're associated with Pithalum, you would welcome that.
Oh, absolutely. You'd be in much better shape than if the federal government was going to do a disclosure. I'd rather listen to what Pithalum and her crowd's got to say. But, yeah. And it's like a tapestry. When it starts, it's going to be catastrophic. You're going to pull one thread, the whole thing's going to come undone. It's going to be a cascading effect. And you won't be able to stop it. And that's what the government knows. That's why it's so afraid of all this stuff. Because imagine a treaty falling out between us and the moon. And let's look at who signed the damn treaty on our side. Won't we want to talk to those people? You know, they better be dead, because if not, they're going to be. That's what I mean. It, I like that catastrophic disclosure. Yeah, that sounds about right to me.
Okay.
That's what it's going to be. It's going to be catastrophic. I think, well, I feel that there is something out there like a, I keep hearing this all the time about Federation of Planets.
Galactic Federation of
Worlds. Galactic Federation. There might be something like that for real. I don't know. Hell, it could be sitting out there past Pluto. Got buoys sitting out there. Careful of this solar system. The third planet from the sun's got a crazy race on it. What was that thing that came through? Maui or
Oumuamua.
It, that thing came, the way it came into the solar system and does a 90 degree exit, that don't happen. That's impossible. Asteroids, comets, whatever, they follow trajectories. They don't suddenly do a 90 degree turn and decide to leave. What the hell was that thing? It could have been an AI. Could have been sweeping through the solar system, picked up all the data it needs off of this planet. I don't know, but I know it wasn't normal, and that was not a normal event. And you talk to any astronomer, hardcore, nothing but numbers and figures astronomers, you know, about as entertaining as a bowl of dust, and they all agree that thing was not normal. Didn't follow no normal path, nothing. And that was probably one of the best evidence of, you know, intelligent external life, was that thing coming and going.
Well, the name itself is Hawaiian. It means advanced scout. So was a precursor to this fleet coming in.
Yeah.
And whether it's the fleet you were told by Pithalum or whether it's associated with the Galactic
Federation. It's a probe. They sent it out just to see if we had interplanetary defense systems up or something, you know.
Mm-hmm. Okay, well, I think this is a good place to finish this interview. So any final words you want to say to people, words of encouragement, what they can look forward to?
Well, just because I dropped out doesn't mean that the rest of you need to drop out. I'm 70 years old. I'm going to keel over anyhow. I'm sorry I failed to give you all the stuff I wanted to, but the negative forces on this planet are just too damn great for an individual to try to overcome. Now, even if I had billions of dollars like Elon Musk, hell, he ain't faring much better than me. You just know his name. He's got rockets blowing up, but he's not really getting anywhere. So I don't know. I may have had some better toys to play with than he's got. But, you know, don't give up. I've ran out of time. That's my problem. I've run out of physical time. I'm going to keel over on you. And, you know, I wish I could be around longer, but I'm not. Too bad. I'm taking a basket of goodies with me, though. I originally had planned to give y'all, but the negative forces on the planet just ain't gonna hear it. But the ideas are out. Now, there is something. They can't kill an idea. They can try like hell. They've been trying for 2,000 years on Christianity. Still can't kill that thing. Proof that an idea will live. So, by me telling you all this stuff, think about what I'm saying. Forget about the messenger. Listen to the message. Shaping metals with sound waves. Growing crystals. That's some really cool shit. That's neat. You don't have to remember me. Hell, I'm just a messenger. But think about the ideas. Explore that. Get away from this planet. It, you know, fusion containment. That's the way to go. And James Webb Telescope just showed us.
James Webb Telescope. Space Telescope.
Thousands of worlds are near us. I mean near. One light year away. That's doable by just about any propulsion system. So, they're out there. Life is all around us. There very well could be a buoy up around us saying, watch out, these beings that live on this third rock from the sun is dangerous. You know, you're liable to land, stick your foot out and draw back a stub. You know, they have a tendency to eat you. So, yeah, they may be avoiding us. But life is all around us. You said to me, what would be really annoying for me, I kill over and find out, well, on the other side, there was a secret space program. I'll kill everybody that's involved in that. I mean, there you are running around with faster than light speed travel, and we're playing with having to deal with chemical rockets over here. God, my, give me a break. Doesn't need to be that way.
Yeah, well, I think you've done a great job over the years in pushing these innovations and getting the information out to people, opening up people's minds to these possibilities, and it's a crying shame that you're shut down so many times.
Yeah.
Your technologies, your inventions, they tried to weaponize those, but I think you've been a true hero. You're kind of a modern-day Nikola Tesla, so I want to thank you, David Adair, for everything you've done and for being on ExoPolitics today.
Take the ideas and run with them.
You have been listening to ExoPolitics Today with Dr. Michael Sala. Please remember to like, share, and subscribe to this channel. Join or start a conversation in the comments. Take the time to explore the vast library of best-selling books, webinars, and podcasts by Dr. Sala. Visit ExoPoliticsToday.com.